Welcome to Brain Ignition Radio. Here I share with you all of the knowledge and resources I've gained as it relates to nutrition, exercise, and brain health. By sharing these interesting case studies, in-depth discussions, and research, I hope that we can learn together and improve our current health and the health of future generations. I'm your host, Chet Binning, and I thank you for tuning in. Welcome, everyone. Thank you again for tuning in to another episode of Brain Ignition Radio. Today, we're going to close out our discussion of nutrition and depression and focus on magnesium, fermented foods, so things like sauerkraut, kimchi, pickled cabbage, some of these other pickled and fermented foods. We'll talk about L-carnitine. We're going to review a lot of the lab tests we've covered already and cover some new ones as well. We're going to talk about MSGs, so monosodium glutamates, which are added to some foods. We'll talk about some other artificial flavoring, such as aspartame, and then a couple other anecdotes and possible tools towards the end. So this will be our conclusion of our... I don't even know how many episodes now we've done. There's been a few, but this is going to be the conclusion of our discussion about nutrition and diet and how that can really have an enormous impact on mental health and even depression. So there's a ton of research about this, and this is what we've been covering for the last few weeks. So if you are just joining us, you're not going to really... miss any important details if you just jump right in on this one. But if you haven't already, either before or after this episode, definitely go back and check out those other ones. As I mentioned last time, I am going to put together a comprehensive summary of everything that we've covered here. I'll do this on social media. And then if anyone is interested in maybe getting this to their email or something else, just let me know and we can definitely work that out, because as I've said many times, I would love to get this out to as many people as possible. I think it is just so much information in here that gets absolutely no recognition, and I think so many people could benefit from it. So I'm going to make today maybe somewhat of a rapid fire. I'm going to do my best just to spend a couple minutes on each of the topics, because I do want to cover all of these in today's episode instead of splitting these up into many more episodes. So let's start with magnesium, shall we? This is probably the most important one on the list for today. Magnesium also has a ton of research to support it. If you've been following me for a while, I hope that by now you appreciate the importance of magnesium. It is so incredibly important. It's probably the most commonly deficient micronutrient, particularly in North America. I can't really speak to the rest of the world. I haven't reviewed that data in a while, but definitely North America. The data shows that over 50% of people in the United States is deficient in magnesium. And the research shows that in Canada, levels are around about 20%. However, as I always express when it comes to magnesium, both of these are likely an underestimation. The deficiency is probably actually a lot higher than this. And it's because of the metric that is used to assess this. So this research, and if you were just to go to your doctor to get your magnesium assessed, by default, they would test what's called serum magnesium. Unfortunately, only about 1% of the total magnesium in your body is found in your serum. And so it's kind of a misleading metric, because you could look awesome based on this, but it really doesn't tell us what is actually going on in your body as it relates to magnesium. So here's another tool for you guys right off the bat. if you get this tested, and this is probably top three on the list, in my opinion, of what would be most important for absolutely everybody to test, not just someone who is struggling with mental health, but it's RBC magnesium or red blood cell magnesium. So this gives us a much better idea of what your true magnesium levels really are. So you might look okay with a serum magnesium, and then your RBC magnesium might tell you that you're in fact deficient. So this is a really critical marker here. So if you don't already know, magnesium in the body and the brain is really a little bit of a panacea. It's just involved in so many different things. It's involved in over 300 enzymatic reactions throughout the body. So that just means that every time there's an important reaction, whether it be to, you know, make hormones or create energy or deal with sickness or inflammation, or, I mean, honestly, everything uses enzymes to carry out those important biological processes. Magnesium is at play here, and it is required. We can use the classic example here of energy. So like I said, magnesium is required to create energy. Specifically, it's required to create ATP. This is the major energy source throughout your body and your brain. And so anecdotally speaking, a lot of people will report that once they start taking magnesium, they just have so much more energy, and it has to do with this. Now, interestingly, magnesium is also probably even more well known for its ability to improve sleep quality. So you might be wondering, well, how can something improve sleep but also improve energy? Isn't that kind of counterintuitive? If it improves sleep, doesn't it make us tired? Well, no, it's just one of these things that, because it's used for so many different things, the body really just knows what to do with it. And so if you take it during the day, it's not going to make you tired. It's going to support energy, but also by having enough, it's also going to support sleep, because it's used for all different things. It's not just one thing. It's not like a caffeine or something like that, where its effect is, you know, very direct, more energy, doesn't depend on the time. Magnesium, like I said, a little bit of a panacea, really a overall support system. Now, the other thing with magnesium that we should cover is how it affects stress. We've talked about how stress really kind of goes hand in hand with depression often. So what the research shows us is that in individuals with depression, there's often some type of HPA axis dysfunction or overactivation. So this would be that system or that communication from the hypothalamus of your brain down to your adrenals, which sit atop your kidneys and release all of the stress chemicals. So it helps you cope with stress. But the point here is that an overactivation of this pathway, so just think of this as excess anxiety, excess stress, being really vulnerable to that, this is often associated with depression. So we know this is what the data shows. Well, it turns out that magnesium is actually critical for controlling this stress response. So specifically what it does is it can lower the stress response. It quite literally makes us more resilient to stress. So just imagine something that typically stresses you out. Well, if you have adequate magnesium, that stressor would be a lot lesser, or a lot weaker, if you will. So more resilient to stress, because as you probably already know, stress it's completely subjective, right? Something that stresses you out, maybe not even affect your friend or someone in your family or whoever. And so this tells us that something within your individual body, your individual brain, is triggering this stress response, meaning that you could also have the opposite, right? So it's not an automatic response. And yes, as I mentioned, having adequate magnesium makes you more resilient to stress. So this is also why, and this is part of the benefit to sleep, but this is also why people will report just overall more calmness when taking adequate levels of high quality magnesium. Now, if you're interested, there is a really interesting specific mechanism at play. And this is just one of the examples, as there's many, but pardon me if I maybe already talked about this in the last episode, I can't remember, but the initial signal, or one of the initial signals that the hypothalamus of your brain will release when we're experiencing stress and anxiety, is CRH. I know we talked about this a little bit last time, and it turns out that having sufficient magnesium will actually dampen this CRH. So it will lower this CRH so that that end signal is not as powerful. So the stress is lower. Now, this is, I would say, one of two primary reasons why magnesium can be beneficial for mental health and depression. The other major reason why is that it can prevent something called overactivation of glutamate receptors, or specifically overactivation of NMDA receptors in the brain. So again, when you feel stressed, when you feel anxious, and also if we have symptoms of depression, one of the things that's going on in the brain is we're actually getting this really high rate of firing of a specific neurotransmitter. And that neurotransmitter is glutamate, and it's binding to the NMDA receptor, it's called. So this action of glutamate binding to NMDA at high levels, because remember, the amount is always most important. It's not just a bad thing. This is one of the things that's going to cause those feelings and those symptoms. Now, the interesting thing about this NMDA receptor is it actually has a block. So in the middle of this receptor, so just think of it as, you can think of it as a gate. This gate along this fence can prevent excess firing of this, excess binding of this neurotransmitter to that receptor. So to back that up very quickly, just so we're kind of all on the same page here, when we have these symptoms, when we feel anxious or stressed or depression, we'll get this really high level of glutamate binding to these NMDA receptors, which then leads to ultimately some of these symptoms that I mentioned. Within this receptor, there's a block, and if that block is in place, it will actually prevent this overfiring. And what is that block? Well, it's magnesium. It's actually called the magnesium block. And so if you have sufficient magnesium, it's going to sit in the middle of that receptor. It does. It just sits right in the middle there, and it will prevent that overfiring. So another really cool specific mechanism of how magnesium can actually, improve some of these symptoms and feelings. Now, there's so many other effects of magnesium. We're not going to get into those. Those are, like I said, probably two of the major ones here. But this is this whole magnesium story. This is why, if there was one single supplement I could pick that I would want absolutely everyone to try, it would be high quality magnesium, and specifically it would be ATP Labs Synermag. Now, that's not the only good supplemental magnesium out there, but it's what I'm most familiar with. And I do know for certain that the good options out there are, there's so few that this is what I know best. So the reason being, because the effects really are so profound, and because, like I said, so many people are deficient, and when they start taking it, it's life-changing. I mean, this was the very first ATP Labs product I ever tried, long before I was ever working for the company. And this was one that almost just this supplement, dramatically improved my sleep. I was never a very good sleeper, but this was one that just had an enormous benefit. And of course, since then, I've made several other tweaks to improve sleep, but this supplement alone was a huge factor for me. Now, before we move on to the next one, I just want to give you guys a couple tips for finding that high quality source. Like I said, if you're looking for one to try, I would strongly encourage you to try ATP Lab Synermag. The reason why it is superior to other options is because it has two different types of magnesium. So it has magnesium glycinate, it also has magnesium malate. So both of these are incredible for absorption. They're highly bioavailable compared to something like a magnesium oxide, which you'll see in every single grocery store. This is very poorly absorbed. Magnesium citrate is another one. Okay for absorption, but you can only take so much before you get diarrhea. So that's not a very good source. You want to be taking pretty high amounts of magnesium, and you can't do that with a citrate. Now, the malate will actually help get magnesium into your muscles, so it can have a calming effect on your muscles, but also support recovery. So some people will get kind of muscle spasms or twitching or quote unquote restless legs when they're in bed trying to sleep. This will help with that. And then the glycinate actually helps get some magnesium into the brain. And there it has that calming effect like we talked about. But the glycine from the magnesium glycinate and the malate from the magnesium malate, they both have their own unique benefits as well. So specifically, the glycine will also have a naturally calming effect. Specifically, one of the things that it does is it will actually promote GABA signaling. So GABA is a inhibitory neurotransmitter in your brain, which means that it has a naturally calming and relaxing effect. And then the other part to this formulation, and remember, if you guys can find another one that has these same ingredients in it, then, you know, that's a really good sign. So that's why I'm explaining this to you. Taurine and B6. So vitamin B6 is required to metabolize magnesium. And taurine is another really important signaling molecule in the brain and throughout the body. So taurine is another one that has a calming effect. You can get some taurine from diet. It's an amino acid naturally found in food. But if you get adequate intake of it, which, you know, is pretty difficult to get from food actually, it too supports GABA signaling, also lowers cortisol, so it lowers stress. So as you can see, all these ingredients really work together synergistically. This is why people will try Synermag and they feel different than if they take, say, just your generic magnesium from the grocery store. If you guys have any questions about, I mean, anything, anytime, obviously I'm all ears, but as well, if you have any questions about Synermag or any of the other products, do not hesitate to reach out to me. Let's move on now to L-carnitine. So you've probably heard of L-carnitine if you, say, have used a fat loss product, perhaps. It's a pretty popular ingredient in those. Reason being is because it does help transport fatty acids into our mitochondria. So what this means is it just makes it makes fat more available for our body to burn as energy, quite simply. But you can find L-carnitine in food. So it's another one that is naturally found in our food. And then sometimes in supplements, it's just isolated and concentrated. The highest source of L-carnitine in diet is actually beef. And there is some quite interesting data, pretty good data too, in fact, supporting the benefit of L-carnitine for individuals with depression. So likely here, one of the things that's probably going on is if someone is deficient in L-carnitine, then of course supplementing that is going to help. I can't say that if you have sufficient levels of L-carnitine is increasing the intake still going to help. I don't know. I would say it's not as likely as the first option, but this is the individual factor, guys, remember. So this is why I do try and explain things to you in a little bit more detail, as opposed to me just saying, oh yeah, L-carnitine is sweet, it's going to help. And then everyone tries it and says, well, Chet, this doesn't do anything. Like, why did you tell me to take this? So remember that is there's always an individual component here. So what does that tell us? Okay, well, if you're someone who does eat a lot of meat, particularly red meat and beef, even better if it is from a grass-fed source, because as we talked about, the nutrient quality does differ depending on the source. Well, then you're probably going to be getting sufficient amounts of L-carnitine. On the other hand, if you follow a vegetarian or perhaps a vegan diet, then you're not going to be getting very much L-carnitine at all, and you might want to consider supplementing this. So another thing with L-carnitine, one of the possible benefits here is it could be improving metabolic flexibility in these individuals taking it. So metabolic flexibility is your ability to, and remember, this goes for your brain as well as your body. It's the ability to use both fat and carbohydrates for energy. So it's the flexibility to jump back and forth as needed. Nowadays, because carbohydrates and sugars are so readily available, we never really go long periods of time without that glucose intake. And so our body is never forced to use the other option. It's never forced to use fat for energy. Just to kind of drive this point home or to help you guys understand it a little bit better, one of the things that happens with a ketogenic diet is you actually shift to primarily using fat for energy, different types of fats, instead of glucose. So by default, what most people are going to use, assuming you stick to kind of your average diet, like you're eating carbohydrates, you're eating fruits, if you are eating processed foods and whatnot, you're going to be utilizing glucose. On the other hand, if you're someone who restricts carbohydrates, doesn't necessarily have to be a full ketogenic diet, like a high fat diet, then you're going to be someone who is mostly using fat for energy. Now you will go back and forth, or I should say you can go back and forth. So not everyone will, because like I said, most people, we have this constant intake of these carbohydrates and sugars that the body will never shift. However, there is some circumstances where you will do that, whether you know it or not. So athletes in particular, because you're burning through so much energy, athletes will sometimes shift back and forth. Now, it's also not an all or none. So you have a bit of a mix of both. So if we use the example of exercise, when you're at a low intensity, you know, just kind of like some easy running or easy biking or whatever, and can easily hold a conversation, you're actually going to be using a lot of fat and some glucose. But as your intensity increases, as your heart rate increases, so think something like a shift in hockey, you're going to be using less fat and more glucose. It's just because your body is it's not able to burn fat at a rate that it is with glucose. And so something like a shift in hockey, you need energy very rapidly, very fast. And so it's going to be mostly glucose. So I digress a little bit, but the point of this is that the majority of people nowadays, because of the average diet, because of inactivity, but even if we are somewhat active and still eat a typical modern day diet, then most people are going to be metabolically inflexible, which means their body's going to be inefficient at switching between fuel sources. Now, how did we get onto this topic? If you could remember, well, it was L-carnitine. And one of the things that L-carnitine does is it actually supports metabolic flexibility. And it turns out that for brain health, one of the most critical things is actually being metabolically flexible. So if you look at the brains of someone with neurodegenerative disease, whether it's Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's or some of these other ones, typically you're going to see metabolic inflexibility. And we don't know if this came before or after the disease, but the point is it's not a good thing for health at all to be inflexible. We want to be flexible. Now, the last thing with L-carnitine I should mention is that if you are supplementing this, there's two different types. You'll see L-carnitine, perhaps a tartrate, and you'll see acetyl L-carnitine. So if you want a carnitine that's able to effectively get into the brain, you want that acetyl L-carnitine. So the added acetyl actually helps it cross the blood-brain barrier. Fermented foods. So perhaps this is a surprising one to people. Fermented foods are interesting because this is something that's been around for thousands and thousands of years. And I strongly believe that if there's a dietary practice that has been used for a really long time, in my opinion, that has some weight. That's really important to me. That says that, well, there must be something going on here, right? If cultures from all around the world have been using this for thousands of years, they must know what's going on with this. There must be some benefits here. Now, this isn't always the case, of course, but with fermented foods, the research is starting to catch up. So while it has been used just based on traditional wisdom being passed on from generation to generation, the research is now starting to catch up and show that, oh yeah, in fact, there is a ton of benefits to fermented foods. And one of the major ones is that it promotes a beneficial gut microbiota. So it supports the bacteria within your gut. This is perhaps one of the most interesting areas of research right now, is the effects of our gut microbiome and just our gut in general on our brain, and specifically depression. So perhaps you've heard about some of this emerging research, but there is some really strong data now to show that having a good gut bacteria, and that's a very general term, but having a certain profile of gut bacteria, which we believe to be good, or the ideal gut bacteria, if you will, has been shown to improve mental health and even symptoms of depression. So we know that there is this constant communication back and forth. So our gut really does strongly influence our brain. Now, most of the studies will use probiotics. So they'll give individuals probiotics and then see how that affects their mood and symptoms. And they'd find benefits. But you don't necessarily always have to use probiotics. And one of the best alternatives is fermented foods. Fermented foods would be things like, and so pardon me if I say, you know, pickled something or something fermented, I kind of use these interchangeably. Of course, it's a little bit different, but they do have similar benefits. So things like sauerkraut, kimchi, pickles, pickled beets, I mean, anything you can find pickled, cabbage, artichokes, and so on. So in addition to supporting the gut microbiome, there's some other interesting benefits of these that might explain some of the benefits that are found in research. And some of these effects are pretty surprising, I think. I know I was surprised when I first stumbled upon these. So in a lot of instances, when something is fermented, so just imagine cabbage undergoing that process, a lot of the micronutrients in it actually become more bioavailable to us. So we're better able to absorb the individual micronutrients that are in them after that food has been fermented. So I thought that was pretty interesting when I first stumbled upon that. But there's some other things that seem to become more concentrated in these foods after they undergo this reaction. And another one of those things would be the antioxidant content, believe it or not. So with a lot of these foods, after they undergo this reaction, the antioxidants that naturally are found in these foods, again, they become more concentrated. So we're better able to get those from the food and then reap the benefits. So this is some pretty interesting stuff. And you know, probably in hindsight, part of the reason why these foods have been so commonly consumed for thousands of years, there is just hundreds and thousands of different foods around the world that are fermented and regularly consumed. I've listed, you know, a small handful of ones here, but there's some that I read about these and I've never even heard of them before. So the list is really quite endless here. Just from an anecdotal standpoint, one of the key changes I made to my diet, I believe, was actually the addition of these. And again, I didn't have any specific tests to show this or anything. This was just a general feeling. You know, how does my digestion feel? How's my energy? How's my mood? It seems that after I introduced these to my daily diet, so I'll have something like, I mean, usually minimum like twice a day with two different meals a day, I'll be having something like pickles or sauerkraut, maybe some cabbage, just whatever we happen to have in the fridge at the time. But after I did this, like I said, it's just a general feeling. I seem to have more energy. Mood is awesome. I don't have really any slumps throughout the day. Whereas beforehand, there definitely was some of that. So, of course, could just be coincidence, but this was something I felt before I actually learned about the benefits of these foods. I should mention that just from a kind of another practical dietary standpoint, these are incredible to work in, even beyond the benefits we've already talked about. They do fill you up quite well. They're very satiating, and the calorie content in them is very, very low. And so they really are a really useful food source for a lot of people, I think. So what about some artificial things we find in food? This is another thing that I think gets, I mean, really no attention. So while things like magnesium get some, but still very little, I think these things that we're about to talk about get basically zero. So I'm talking about things like MSG for one, and then some artificial flavors like aspartame. So starting with MSG, this is monosodium glutamate. You can check this out on a food label. You'll see this in things like microwavable meals for one. So a lot of those high convenience foods, often chips, different pops and iced teas, instant noodles, deli meats, soy sauce, and fast food. And I, as I'm kind of going over these, I realize that you actually won't find these on all of the labels. I'm not sure if it's a requirement. I don't know if it has to be listed, but these will often be added usually to improve the flavor. Sometimes they're added in place of salt or sodium as another tactic to, if the manufacturer wants to reduce the amount of sodium that they have to put on the label, they'll add this in place. Now, if we look at the name of this, maybe you guys have already guessed what a potential problem of this is, but it's monosodium glutamate. Now, if you remember, we talked about glutamate earlier in this episode when we were covering magnesium. So remember, glutamate is that neurotransmitter in the brain. It binds to particularly NMDA receptors. And if we have high levels of this, so if this happens excessively, that's what causes symptoms and side effects. So can the glutamate found in monosodium glutamate actually elevate glutamate in the brain? Absolutely, it can. And this is one of the problems with these foods, is that it can do that quite rapidly, actually. And so the overconsumption of these is another red flag. We have to be mindful of this. Again, going to be very individual. Not everyone is going to be as sensitive to this. The other thing we have to consider here is the overall level. It's the level of these foods that we're consuming, or the amounts that we're consuming. If you're having one of these foods, some chips or whatever it is, occasionally, it's not going to be a big deal for most people unless you're really sensitive to this. But again, as we've talked about time and time again, so many of these foods are becoming staples. They're becoming an everyday thing in people's diets. And not only that, they're becoming a multiple times per day food source. And that's really what's going to lead to the problem here, guys, is the excessive amounts of processed foods, and in this specific scenario, MSGs. It's funny though, a lot of times I don't think we really connect the dots. People maybe have maybe they have a day or a night or a string of a couple days or whatever where they kind of just go off the rails, and then during or afterwards they just feel like complete crap, but don't really maybe think anything of it or don't connect the dots. Well, it's funny, like that isn't just, as I always say, just happens for no particular reason. Like there is a reason for that. There's something that's actually going on in your body, going on in your brain, that's causing you to feel that way. So I bring this up because I know for sure there's people out there who maybe every time they eat a specific processed food, or maybe every time they do that for an extended period of time, they probably get these specific symptoms and have maybe never thought about it this way. So like I said, it's the amount here that's most important, guys. This is another really important individual factor. Some people are going to have a lower baseline level of glutamine, and so this isn't as much of an issue. Other people are going to have a higher baseline, and so they're going to be more sensitive to this. So maybe like one meal of instant noodles or a Hungry Man meal, which I cannot believe those are still sold, is going to be more sensitive to the side effects of how you feel after this. But like we've already covered many times over, is you can really overcomplicate these things and talk about the individual ingredients in that processed food and what it does in the body. But as you've found out by now, you can really, really simplify things. What it comes down to 9 times out of 10 is it real food? If it's real food, it's going to be okay for 90% of people and going to be good for those people. If it's processed food, there's some potential side effects, and we've covered some of those side effects. And with anything, as we've talked about over and over again, it's not going to affect everyone as much as others, but this is what the data tells us. And if we just want to lower our risk, these are going to be important steps. But most importantly, if someone is at risk, if they are experiencing these problems, if they're, you know, low mood, in the dumps, feeling terrible, and they're not thinking about these things, this could totally help these people. And that's why we're talking about this. Now, similarly, aspartame can have some negative effects on the brain. This is another one that's newly emerging. So there's not a ton of research on this. The majority of it is preclinical, which means that a lot of it is in animal data and we're kind of still finding out more. However, my opinion, and this is just my personal opinion, people are, of course, free to disagree, is that I don't think we should be surprised when we start to find out that these artificial flavors or sweeteners or chemicals or additives or whatever they are have negative effects on us. I don't think that should be a surprise. After all, these are synthetic chemicals, and everything we put into our body has an effect. It has a side effect, whether that's positive or negative or somewhere in between. Think of food as, it's really a signaling molecule. So it is the energy, of course, that you get from that food. So it's the calories, it's the carbs and the fats. But that's really only the beginning. What are these foods and these ingredients doing after that? How are they affecting our hormone? Are they affecting our immune system? What are they doing to our gut? Are they doing something to our hormones or immune system or our gut that's changing the neurochemistry in our brain? This is what I want people to kind of start to understand and appreciate, is that there's no biological free lunch, and everything we put into our body or into our biology has an effect. So aspartame, again, some people, and I've heard of this one a lot, is some people are incredibly sensitive to this. They will drink, one Diet Coke or something with a bit of aspartame, and they just feel like garbage. Their mood tanks, they have no energy. This does influence our brain. So this is another important thing to consider. But same thing, amounts matter, the individual matters. So those are really the big ones for today, guys, that I wanted to cover. There's so many others that I'm not going to get into because I think we've covered such a long list already. One thing I will add is you can really make a case for a long list of micronutrients as being a factor here. So if someone is deficient in something like B5 or B6 or B9 or B12, some of these, of course, are more common than others. We know that B12 is one of the most common ones. Vitamin C, we could throw that in there. Zinc is another one. Perhaps iron as well. We know that that's common. But if people are deficient in these, which is unfortunately relatively hard to find out nowadays, it's difficult to get these tests, this could absolutely affect our mood and affect our brain chemistry. Because a lot of these vitamins, particularly the B vitamins, have a really strong role in metabolism. So basically how our body deals with energy, but also in specifically how our brain creates different chemicals. If we jump back to one of our earlier examples about dopamine and serotonin and everything we talked about with those, a couple B vitamins are required to make those. So B12 is one example. We actually require B12 to make serotonin. And we need serotonin to make melatonin. So that's a pretty interesting pathway, right? If B12 is low, well, then our serotonin is going to be low, which will negatively affect our mood. And then that could negatively affect our melatonin, which is going to impair sleep quality. So you can see how everything is so tightly connected and how one thing can really disturb the balance of everything else. Not that this is directly relevant right now, but it's just interesting to kind of tie this together, is that B12 is, it's another thing that just makes it so interesting, is that its metabolism after we consume it in our gut is pretty unique, actually. So it requires something called intrinsic factor in the gut, which actually makes it available for proper digestion so that it can go on to do these other things. And one of the most interesting things about this is probably one of the most interesting pieces of research I've ever found, was that some certain pharmaceuticals like PPIs or proton pump inhibitors, they'll actually impair our ability to absorb B12 from our diet. It's because the stomach acid is required to basically trigger that process to absorb B12. And these PPIs and these antacids, many of them will block our natural production of stomach acid, which means that we don't absorb B12, leading to potential B12 deficiency. So if we think now about, okay, we're taking these drugs, we might be thus driving down our levels of B12. What could that affect throughout the rest of the body and the brain? Well, I just said it has a really important influence on serotonin, melatonin, and different pathways in the brain. And so it can absolutely negatively affect those. In fact, this is why, if you go into the research right now and you look up, say, something like PPIs and dementia, there are some just incredible strong associations between long-term proton pump inhibitor use and dementia. It's so incredible, but when you think about it, it just makes so much sense. If we're always taking these, we're going to be driving down our B12. And if you're not doing things to mitigate that, well, then you're going to be negatively impacting your brain chemistry. And in this specific example, negatively affecting melatonin in the brain. Melatonin is one of the most important things in your brain, period. Not only is it important for sleep, but it's also one of the strongest antioxidants throughout your entire body. So it just helps you clean up all the garbage and debris that you accumulate throughout your life. So imagine missing out on that now for a long period of time. This is potentially why we see that strong, strong association in the research. It's really interesting stuff. So we won't get too much more into that. The other thing we didn't really cover, which is equally as important as everything we've talked about, but it's not specifically diet, which is why I didn't talk about it, is circadian rhythm. So your sleep-wake cycle. When you wake up, when you get sunshine, what you do at nighttime, whether you have all your lights on, watch screens, or are you controlling that? Are you dimming lights, turning lights off? Are you, going to bed at the same time? There's really a lot of important things there as well. It's one of the reasons why shift work is so bloody hard on the body, unfortunately. But I think we're going to save that for a future episode. And then if you guys have any other questions about some of the more kind of nuanced options out there, there is a lot more that we're not going to dig into. There's some adaptogens in particular that also have some strong data to support their benefits to depression and alleviating symptoms of depression. So things like ginseng, for example, or rhodiola rosea, if you've heard of this one, that's another one that affects dopamine and some of the neurotransmitters in our brain, and do have supporting research to show that it can benefit depression. But that's all we're going to cover for now. Hope you guys really liked this series. Please do share this with others if you think that they could benefit from it. Friends, family, whoever. I'd really appreciate that if you enjoyed it. Leave a review, and a comment as well if you can. That's what helps bump this podcast up so that more people can find it. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to switch gears a little bit. One thing we're going to do that I'm really excited about is review my lab work. So I had some lab work done. I measured actually a lot of these markers that we've already discussed in these episodes. It's going to be really cool. We're going to talk about what I found and what I can do to change these things, but also what I've done to kind of control these things beforehand. We'll do some Q&As in there as well. I definitely want to do more Q&A for you guys because I do get lots of questions, and sometimes that's my favorite style actually, because it's just straightforward for me and it doesn't let me ramble on too much and get all sidetracked. So that's all for now. Let me know what you guys think. Otherwise, hope you have a healthy week.